University and arrested by the police, tagging in the Prime Minister, Home Secretary, Ofcom, the BBC and Oxford University. In fact, Giorgiano was in a team of four which had collectively picked the octopus, as it was one of their favourite animals. The jacket worn by Miss Giorgiani on the show was navy, blue, orange, pink and green. Malika Giorgiano received death threats and abuse after Baroness Foster smeared her. Foster recently apologised, saying, "I wrongfully alleged that Miss Giorgiano chose a blue octopus as her team's mascot, which I held her responsible for. I accept that these allegations were completely false and unfounded. I made a grave mistake in making those posts, and I should not have done so." Naturally, prior to making her racist comments, the Baroness had been on a lobby trip in May 2023 to occupied Palestine, with flights and accommodation paid for by Zionist group Elnet UK. Elnet UK was set up by Joan Ryan, famous for inventing anti-Semitic slurs against Labour Party members, as exposed in the lobby, and by Paul Charney, a former tank commander for the genocidal occupation forces. Foster is also on the senior advisory board of the Drone Delivery Group Limited, a lobby group for the drone industry. As is well known, the occupation forces in Palestine are increasingly making use of drones to more effectively commit genocide in Gaza. But in the end, is a blue octopus actually an anti-Semitic trope? In fact, blue octopi are regularly used by Jewish groups in a positive way, as in this children's book on Oscar the Octopus, and in other examples. Zionist propaganda is increasingly overreaching and overheating. More and more people are becoming instinctively resistant to it. It remains to be seen how long it will continue to be deployed to any effect by the Zionists.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm pleased to welcome back Steve Headley as our guest contributor today, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Steve is a lifelong socialist and trade unionist who was the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the RMT Trade Union until quite recently. He's also been an anti-racist, pro-Palestinian activist all his adult life. His book, Derry Boy, was published in January and quickly sold out at his book launch at the Bookmarks Bookshop in central London. Welcome to the show. David, why on earth do these senior politicians believe these fairy tales? I like the idea that the blue octopus is got some inherent anti-Jewish meaning. And it's absolutely preposterous, isn't it?
Well, it is preposterous, and we should treat it with the derision it deserves. It doesn't deserve any proper analysis. It's just a joke. I mean, these people are just jokers. But the people who believe it are people who either are paid-up Zionists or have been convinced by paid-up Zionists that this is the case. And the Zionists will give them pictures of octopus, like this lovely Hanukkah octopus Oscar here.
Yes.
And they will say, actually, this was used by the Nazis. And therefore, any representation of a blue octopus must be anti-Semitic, except, of course, the ones which are not anti-Semitic. And it's used quite widely in Jewish folklore, in Hanukkah illustrations, as a pro-Jewish thing. So it's completely ridiculous, and it's used just to weaponize anything that can be weaponized against those who criticize Zionism.
Yeah. Well, I started by asking Steve about the hysteria being generated to vilify opposition to the Gaza genocide, like the ludicrous complaints against the university challenge students' mascot and jacket.
Well, I mean, it's quite obvious to anybody with a brain cell why she was targeted, and that's because of her ethnicity. I mean, she was a brown person, and brown people are anything they wear can be interpreted, it seems these days, as either in support of Palestine or as somehow anti-Semitic. And I think that this is an agenda for other Zionists to try to close down any debate and any criticism, to frighten people, to freeze people into submission. And I think it's backfiring badly, because people are not being intimidated. They're out in the streets, and the people are wearing Palestinian colours very proudly.
David, Latifa's report there said that Baroness Foster's involved with this obscure British Israel lobby group, Elnet. What more can you tell us about them?
So ELNET is a European leadership network, and it was set up in Brussels. It's been one of the key Brussels Israel lobby groups for some years now, but they recently set up a British branch, which is created by Joan Ryan, who famously, from the lobby programme, famously invented anti-Semitic abuse against her. And of course, by
Labour MP, of course.
Former Labour MP, and of course, this guy called Charney, who's been involved in a whole range of Zionist organisations, former IDF tank commander. And his function is, as with all Israel lobby groups, is to radicalise and propagandise decision makers. And of course, that's why they've taken decision makers from Parliament to occupied Palestine, including this woman who went on a trip last year, I think it was.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's what these organisations are for. They're there to make sure that decision makers in the House of Lords or the House of Commons who are not already signed up to Zionism can be turned to become fanatical pro-Zionists.
Right. Well, the young woman on the University Challenge was singled out specifically because was visibly Muslim. So I asked Steve for his thoughts on this deeply disturbing trend in Zionist messaging.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think the Zionists weren't expecting the absolute backlash to the genocide in Gaza. Not only Muslims, but 70%, over 70% of the British population, the entire British population, regardless of religion or ethnicity, want to stop to this genocide. They want an immediate ceasefire. But the people that the Zionists are targeting in order to build a profile of somehow violent or extreme elements is the Muslim population, and it's completely untrue. I mean, I've personally been on every demonstration. I've seen very, very little violence at all. The main violence that I saw was from members of the English Defence League who had been summoned to a counter demonstration by Tommy Robinson, but that by and large, their marches have passed off without incident. So again, I think their strategy has been ineffective.
Well, as I was saying, David, I mean, the Zionist lobby's really lost the plot on this one, haven't they? I mean, Latifa's report highlighted that the Blue Octopus, and I think you were just making the point, actually, is actually a Jewish-friendly image. I mean, how much more ridiculous can these characters get?
Well, they've overreached, right? They overreached in this case where they lost the libel action. And actually, the solicitors who took the case for this young Muslim student were the same solicitors who won my case in the tribunal. So, Zilla from Zilla Rabin and Zach Samour from 11KBW. So they've taken this case and they've shown that actually you can't just say any old nonsense about people and expect to get away with it. So they've won in this case. Now, in examples like this, here's another happy blue octopus. This is an image from a garment which is being sold on Amazon. Not in any sense anti-Semitic, obviously. But yet, nevertheless, whenever they can try and find a way to, however circuitously, to link a particular image to anti-Jewish hatred, they will take it because, of course, they are desperate to find ways to criticise and to destroy those of us who are pro-Palestinian because that's what's happening. They're creating genocide in Gaza, and they have to find a way to fight back.
And particularly targeting Muslims, as we've seen. Well, I then asked Steve about Baroness Foster's involvement in the deadly drone industry and what that tells us about the values of many of those who are currently engaged in British public life.
Well, I think when we've got Zionists and admitted Zionists who are in lobby groups with Israel and are also members of the House of Lords or baronesses, and they're involved in drones that are being used to kill people in Palestine, innocent people in Palestine, we have to ask, who is running politics in this country? Have we got a foreign country in the shape of Israel interfering in politics in this country? We have to look at the Israeli lobby and who they're funding in Parliament, in the House of Lords and in the House of Commons. Because if this was Russian influence, for example, there would be a whole hue and cry about it. There would be an investigation. But it seems to be accepted that the Israeli lobby can sponsor MPs, giving them huge sums of money, foster lords and give them huge sums of money, and absolutely nothing is said.
Well, it's time for our next report now, and then we'll come back to the discussion. This one outlines some of the other farcical examples of Zionist hyperbole.
Hissing is now apparently anti-Semitic too. On the 29th of February, the latest Zionist overreach claimed that hissing at a council meeting in Newham, East London, was an act of anti-Semitism, since snakes, which are among those creatures that hiss, have been used in anti-Jewish propaganda. Three socialist activists were later arrested at midnight for racial harassment under the Public Order Act in a shameful misuse of police time and resources. They deny any hissing. The councillor, Josh Garfield, denounced the alleged hissing as an attempt to bully him out of public life as a result of his ethnicity. The pathetic level of the victimhood is astonishing. The alleged hissing is audible for no more than 3 seconds, and then there's Garfield's response.
If members in the gallery want to hiss me, they might wish to speak to my face about the issues they have. But, Chair, I won't accept it.
I'm going to adjourn the meeting for 15 minutes.
Garfield is, of course, a card-carrying Zionist, being a member of the National Executive of the Racist Jewish Labour Movement, which is formally affiliated to the Zionist movement. The mayor of Newham, Roxana Fayaz, who is a Muslim, issued a strong statement the next day, nonsensically referring to anti-Semitic abuse. Across the ages, tropes like the use of snakes have been used to fuel stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination against Jewish people. Why would Fayaz say that? Maybe it was her attendance the day before the council session at the annual dinner of the Community Security Trust, the group which runs point for the genocidal Zionist regime. In a speech at the council meeting before the alleged incident, she specifically raised comments by the Prime Minister there about the alleged increase in violence and intimidation against elected representatives.
Last night, I was with members of the Jewish community over at the Community Security Trust event in central London. The Prime Minister was there, and he did speak about something that resonated with me. He spoke about the significant increase in violence and intimidatory behaviour being faced by elected representatives.
Alternatively, part of the reason might be the advisory role in a Zionist lobby group, the European Institute for the Study of Contemporary Antisemitism. Among the directors of EISCA were Chairman Stephen Pollard, who later presided over a record-breaking run of falsehood at the Jewish Chronicle, Jeremy Newmark, later disgraced in a scandal over missing cash from the Jewish Leadership Council, and Dennis McShane, a former Labour MP jailed for expenses fraud. Among the other members of the advisory board were a who's who of Islamophobes and or extremist Zionists, including Michael Wine of the Community Security Trust. Back in 2009, EICSA were denounced as a dubious body involved in the sad politicizing of anti-Semitism by Tony Lehrman, the leading authority on the political uses of anti-Semitism. The trope bandwagon will continue rolling until it's brought to a halt by a collective refusal to take seriously the genocidal nonsense spouted by Zionists.
Well, Steve was an eyewitness to the so-called Newham Snakegate rumpus, so I asked him to describe what happened and what the atmosphere was like when the Zionist councillor claimed that he'd been subjected to anti-Semitic hissing.
Yeah, well, first of all, we went as members of the Trades Council, the Trade Union Council down in Newham to oppose £17 million worth of cuts to the budget, which would meant destroying the special educational needs budget, redundancies, and the decimation of services right across Newham. So everybody from the Labour Party who went up to defend the cuts got heckled. I mean, there were a few choice comments made. Now, this so-called hissing, I didn't hear it. Then on the night I didn't hear it, I was sitting right beside one of the persons accused and right behind one of the other person accused. I was sitting about 4 paces or 5 paces from the third person who was accused, and I will tell you now, absolutely none of them hissed whatsoever. They did not hiss. But the atmosphere in the place was, critical of the Labour Party. Then we had the mayor, Roxana Fiaz, who opened the meeting by giving a statement of how she'd met Rishi Sunak, and how her and Rishi Sunak were completely opposed to intimidating political opponents, and we can't have people criticised. We can't have politicians criticised in a way that would upset them. And she kind of set the scene for this guy who came on called Garfield, and he came up to the rostrum and he turned around and said, can people stop hissing behind my back? And we all looked at each other and went, what's he on about? No one's hissing. Certainly we couldn't hear any hissing from where we were sitting. And then the chair of the meeting shut the meeting down, and somehow this hissing that I couldn't hear was interpreted as anti-Semitic in some way. Now, I have no idea how this interpretation was reached. I didn't even know the guy's name at the time. I didn't know his religion. I didn't know anything about him. But even if people were hissing, why would it be anti-Semitic? I mean, couldn't it just be like the Barry coming on in a program, in a theatre even, when people would hiss? He's about to make £17 million worth of cuts. Maybe people would have hissed. How would they know his religion? How would they possibly know his religion? And I think it's a sort of trope that can be turned the other way. Why would people hiss at Jewish people? I don't understand it. And what is that trope all about? So the atmosphere that night, I believe, was if you like, a setup. I think people reacted at the first opportunity to anything that they could interpret as anti-Semitic, and used it to try and sully the name of not only the trade union protesters, but the independent councillors that were present as well.
Well, David, I mean, do we know if this councillor Garfield character has ever been involved in any phony anti-Semitism incidents in the past?
Oh, yes, indeed, Chris, we do. He's been involved in all sorts of phony anti-Semitism incidents in the past. He was a participant in the Panorama programme, Is Labour Anti-Semitic?, when he couldn't even come up with an anti-Semitic allegation. He said that he was sometimes called a dirty Zionist, as if that was in some way anti-Jewish. And, of course, he's previously denounced Momentum in the local area as being anti-Semitic, without producing any evidence. He has a long, long history of this. If you go back to some years before that, he's, of course, been involved with radicalising young kids in Zionist summer camps and the usual sorts of connections that these kind of people have. He's in the Jewish Labour Movement, yeah, on the national executive of that organisation. So, yeah, he's making a career. He's not even 30, and he's making a career out of fake anti-Semitism allegations.
Right. Well, I then asked Steve about the background of the three socialists who were targeted in this incident.
Yeah, there are three members of our trades council. They're three active trade unionists. I think they're also members of the Palestinian Solidarity Committee, but that's not the reason that they were there that night. So why they would think that it was those three particular people and not anybody else? I mean, I wasn't cautioned for hissing, or I had the police coming around my house. They said that it was hissing, and I was sitting right beside one of them. So how could they distinguish it from being him and not me? It made this alleged hissing noise. It's just bizarre. It doesn't make sense. So I think, again, there's an element of people who have been active on the issue of Palestine, active in opposing the genocide, have been singled out because of their political activities, and they're trying to be silenced.
David, the elected mayor in Newham's got some history with Islamophobic Zionist lobby groups, doesn't she?
She has. I mean, she has been involved for a long time in the area of extremism and radicalisation, and she was involved with this anti-Muslim, anti-Semitism group where she was on the advisory board. Then she became the chief executive officer of an interfaith group dedicated to undermining Muslim opposition to British imperialism and to wars. And then she was, after that, the chief executive of another organisation, which is run by a guy who is a personal friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. So right. She has a long history of involvement with Zionism and with Zionist interfaith groups. So it's not surprising that she would make this kind of statement, which she made in Newham, to back up Garfield's nonsense about snakes.
Well, I also asked Steve whether he thought the police were targeting these pro-Palestine activists, or whether the mayor was to blame, and whether he thought this was a colossal waste of police time.
I think that the names of these individuals were given to the police by the councillors in the hall, or perhaps the mayor. I don't know which of them did it, perhaps both. But there's no way that the police would have known who these people were if the Labour councillors and the mayor hadn't pointed them out. And I can reiterate, and I will go to court and swear this, I heard no hissing whatsoever, and certainly there was no hissing coming from the person beside me, the person in front of me, or the person just off to my left. I just think we're in a very dangerous time where the opposition to the war in Gaza is growing in strength. And I think that the government and the Labour Party want to defuse that opposition. And I think that there's no lie or slander that they won't use in order to make out that people are somehow violent or anti-Semitic or otherwise behaving improperly. And, you know, it's just not true. And Labour have to understand that their policy is very unpopular. The government's policy is very unpopular. Most Labour supporters, the vast majority of Labour supporters, want a ceasefire now, and Labour are not delivering that, and they will pay. They will pay at the ballot box. People will not vote for them, and I hope that people will vote for candidates that are demanding peace in Palestine.
David, what would you advise people who are caught up in these Orwellian situations like this?
What happens when people are caught up in these situations usually is that they are surprised by what's happened because, of course, they've not done anything wrong. They're usually anti-racists. Indeed. They've not been anti-Semitic. And they don't understand that this is this is something serious. And they sort of think that it can go away or you can try and discuss it with people and it will be fine. But it won't be fine. This is an all-out attack, in this case, on people from the left. But usually it's on people who are Palestinian or Arab or Muslim of origin, they deliberately target Muslims for this kind of activity. You need to get advice swiftly. Don't speak to anyone else until you've got advice, preferably from a lawyer, but from comrades, trusted people who you know who understand these kinds of things. Don't take the route of saying, I'll apologise and go away. Because as I know, that never works.
It's weaponised against you.
So you need to make sure that you've got proper advice and that you can take on these people so that you can get involved in the processes which can fight back against them.
No, indeed.
As, of course, you've
absolutely. Well, look, I mean, the apologies weaponisers are saying, they're then used, well, he must have known he's done something wrong, and then that gives them licence then to go further. Well, anyway, that's it now for another show. So thank you. And thanks, obviously, to our guest, Steve Headley, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In New York, United States, a judge has delayed the start of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial. Judge Juan Merchan delayed the trial until mid-April because of discovery issues. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. The judge overseeing former President Donald Trump's New York hush money case has delayed the start of the trial from its original 25th of March start date due to discovery issues raised by the defense. Trial on this matter is adjourned for 30 days from the date of this letter, Judge Juan Merchan wrote on Friday, 15th of March, which would push the new trial date to mid-April. The judge scheduled a hearing for 25th of March to address the discovery concerns. Lawyers for Donald Trump were seeking to delay the start of the trial in order to allow them to review tens of thousands of pages of potential evidence recently disclosed by the Justice Department. Judge Juan Merchan, in his ruling on Friday, 15th of March, said, "There are significant questions of fact he must resolve before he decides whether the Manhattan District Attorney flouted its obligations to disclose potential evidence as alleged by the defense." On Thursday, 14th of March, the Manhattan District Attorney's office proposed a delay of up to 30 days to give the parties time to review newly discovered material related to former Trump attorney Michael Cohen. Donald Trump's attorneys were seeking an even longer delay. 30 days is not sufficient given the volume of recently produced materials and the nature of the ongoing disputes, Trump attorney Todd Blanche said in a letter to Judge Juan Merchan. "Therefore, we respectfully request that the court schedule a hearing on the pending discovery motion and the scheduling of a trial date, should one be necessary, at a time that is convenient to Your Honor, during the week of 25th of March." Donald Trump last April pleaded not guilty to a 34-count indictment charging him with falsifying business records in connection with a hush money payment that Michael Cohen made to film actress Stormy Daniels just days before the 2016 presidential election. In seeking the delay, the defense also repeated its insistence that the indictment must be dismissed. "The people's consent to an adjournment of the trial is a necessary step towards a just resolution of these proceedings, but the court must not permit that request to obscure the need to dismiss the indictment as a whole, or at the very least for inquiry and fact-finding into the circumstances that put Your Honor and President Trump in this position, based on ongoing discovery violations," the defense said. Jury selection for the trial is currently scheduled to get underway on 25th of March in New York City. The former President Donald Trump has denied all wrongdoing. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. A judge on Friday, 15th of March, delayed Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial until at least mid-April, after the former president's lawyers said they needed more time to sift through a profusion of evidence they only recently obtained from a previous federal investigation into the matter. Judge Juan Manuel Merchan agreed to a 30-day postponement and scheduled a hearing for 25th of March to address questions about the evidence dump. The trial has been slated to start on 25th of March. It is among four criminal indictments against Donald Trump, the presumptive 2024 Republican presidential nominee. Trump's lawyers wanted a 90-day delay to the trial, which would have pushed the start of the trial into early summer. Prosecutors said they were okay with a 30-day adjournment in an abundance of caution and to ensure that the defendant has sufficient time to review the new materials. Trump's lawyers said they have received tens of thousands of pages of evidence in the last 2 weeks from U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, which investigated the hush money arrangement while Donald Trump was president. The evidence includes records about former Trump lawyer turned prosecution witness Michael Cohen that are exculpatory and favorable to the defense. Trump's lawyer said, prosecutors say most of the newly turned over material is largely irrelevant to the subject matter of this case, though some records are pertinent. The hush money case centers on allegations that Donald Trump falsified his company's records to hide the true nature of payments to Michael Cohen, who paid actress Stormy Daniels $130,000 during the 2016 presidential campaign to suppress her claims about Donald Trump. Trump pleaded not guilty last year to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records and has denied having any encounters with Stormy Daniels. His lawyers argue the payments to Michael Cohen were legitimate legal expenses and were not part of any cover-up. Prosecutors contend that Trump's lawyers caused the evidence problem by waiting until 18th of January, a mere 9 weeks before the scheduled start of jury selection, to subpoena the U.S. Attorney's Office for the full case file. District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office said it requested the full file last year, but the U.S. Attorney's Office only turned over a subset of the records. Trump's lawyers received that material last June and had ample time to seek additional evidence from the federal probe, the district attorney's office is claiming. Short trial delays because of issues with evidence aren't unusual, but any delay in a case involving Donald Trump would be significant, with trial dates in his other criminal cases up in the air and election day less than 8 months away. The defense has also sought to delay the trial until after the U.S. Supreme Court rules on Donald Trump's presidential immunity claims, which, as lawyers say, could apply to some of the allegations and evidence in the hush money case. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral arguments on 25th of April. Donald Trump has repeatedly sought to postpone his criminal trials while he campaigns to retake the White House.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different dimensions of the concept of humanity in the Holy Quran and the teachings that the Holy Quran has in this regard. In the previous episode, we ended up talking about different faculties of the human soul. We talked about the heart, we talked about intellect and reason, and we were talking about the obstacles that stop reason from functioning properly, and one of them was blindly following the tradition or the social habits. Another is blind obedience or blindly following the great ones or the personalities or the figures in the society. And said, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, the verse that reads, on the day of judgment, one excuse that wrongdoers bring for their action is that they say, "Inna ta'na sadatana." It is because we did this because our masters told us to do so. Or wakubara'ana, the figures and the like famous popular figures in the society, they told us or they did something and we followed the suit and we did whatever they did. And I said, this looks like some elements of it looks like the elements that we see in the cult of personality, that some people, they are so much devoted to a person without any proper reason, sometimes because they have some poverty in their soul, some holes, some problems, some insufficiency of the self that they find to fill it up with the devotion to another person, this in itself might not be bad, because there are good applications of that as well. And the good application is when you take a role model for yourself. Taking a role model, especially if it is done according to your rational analysis, rational assessment, is something good in all careers, all the things that we do to achieve success. It's very difficult to achieve success without role models. Role models are very good to have. It's no problem. But the problem arises when some people, the role model that they have, for example, let's assume I like soccer, football, and I like this football player very much, but this relationship goes beyond this field of soccer playing, and it goes to other areas of life. Well, I forget that, well, he's a good person in the field, in the soccer field, and he shoots the ball well, I don't know. But doesn't mean he is a good role model in terms of the, I don't know, akhlaq or manners or anything else. And this happens with people, especially the youth, that they sometimes lose the compass that they had because of the devotion, inner devotion that you have to a personality. And they think that whatever that he does or she does, I don't know, based on the celebrity that they have, and pretty much like the cult of personalities, they have fans, as you have heard. And these fans, sometimes they go to the extreme level, and exactly the behaviors that you see in the cult of personality, you see among these fans, so-called fans. And yes, and sometimes the behavior that they have overflow to society as well. And you see a trend in society that starts because of that, such celebrity did something, and then his fans or her fans, they continue doing that in the communities, and completely according to the verses of the Holy Quran, there are some instances of ata'na sadatana wa kubara'ana, just because they're figures, famous, popular, everybody else, without even questioning or critical thinking, follow them. We will have a break and we come back to continue our discussion.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to the program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the first episode, we were left with a little bit of the discussion that we had in the previous episode about the cult of personality as one obstacle in the way of reason, proper fulfillment of the duties of the reason. And we said sometimes those excuses and empty justifications actually will hinder a person from following what he thinks correct, and it changes the compass of the person to the wrong direction. Another obstacle on the way of reason is conceit and arrogance, according to the verses of the Holy Quran. And these are not actually exclusive, meaning that a person could have all of these together, like blind following of the social habits, blind or devotion to one personality, and at the same time arrogance, which stops a person from rethinking and reconsideration of his behaviors. So the verse of the Holy Quran in this regard reads like this: إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ, those who يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ, it means that those who fight with the verses of the Holy Quran, or with the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, better to be translated. Ayat means signs. They do jadal, they always argue against the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imagine if you're driving and there's a sign telling you, yes, there's a danger, and you stop and you, I don't know, start fighting with the sign, trying to destroy it or trying to say, no, this doesn't mean that, this playing with it, arguing it. The sign's function is to help you find your direction. If you start arguing against it, doesn't help. So, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ بِغَيْرِ سُلْطَانٍ أَتَاهُمْ. Without any basis, without any sultan means here. Here means solid evidence. بِغَيْرِ سُلْطَانٍ, without any solid evidence. Just because there's a possibility that the narrative of, I don't know, creation could be different than. It's just a possibility. You don't have solid evidence for that. You don't have solid evidence about anything. Like the claims of Alam al-Ghayb that the Quran makes, we don't have solid evidence. Only because there's a possibility, there's a probability that this is different, it doesn't make your case valid. But they just bring in those possibilities, those probabilities. بَغَيْرِ سُلْطَانٍ, without any. We will talk about it when we talk about conjecture. People who follow conjecture. إِنْ فِي صُدُورِهِمْ إِلَّا كِبْرٌ مَا هُمْ بِبَالِغِي. They do that only because of the arrogance, because of the conceit, because they want to show themselves as, yes, I'm a person of my own, I'm different, I don't know. So this is kibr, this is to have like attention-seeking disorder, to be at the center of the attention of others, always arguing with the truth, always arguing without any sultan, without any solid evidence. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us not to fall into the traps of shaitan, and to help us understand the beautiful teachings of our religion. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, until next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sallallahu ala Muhammad, sallallahu ala Nabi, sallallahu ala Muhammad وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Israeli military has restricted the delivery of humanitarian aid to northern Gaza for weeks, and thousands of Palestinian children are currently going without adequate food and medication. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered the story and tells us more. The United States' controversial decision to pause its funding for the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, earlier this year is reportedly likely to become permanent. Reuters carried out the report on Wednesday, 13th of March, attributing the likelihood to opposition at Congress to the country's financial contribution to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. UNRWA provides healthcare, education, and other vital services to the Palestinian population in Gaza. The agency was accused by Israel in January of having links to a 7th of October operation launched by Gaza Strip's Palestinian resistance movements against the occupying regime in response to the intensification of Tel Aviv's decades-long crimes against Palestinians. The allegations prompted more than 10 donor countries, including the United States, Germany, the European Union, Canada, and Japan, to suspend all financial support of UNRWA. The funding from these countries used to make up the bulk of the funding received by the agency. The collective move against UNRWA came amid mass displacement and approaching all-out famine across Gaza, prompted by an ongoing genocidal war that the Israeli regime has been waging against the coastal sliver in response to the 7th of October surprise operation by the resistance in Gaza. According to the Reuters report, the bipartisan opposition in Congress to funding UNRWA makes it unlikely the United States will resume regular donations to UNRWA anytime soon, even as countries such as Sweden and Canada have said they will restart their contributions to UNRWA. A supplemental funding bill in the U.S. Congress that includes military aid to Israel and Ukraine contains a provision that would block UNRWA from receiving funds if it becomes law, adding, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration supports the bill. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters on Tuesday, 13th of March, "We have to plan for the fact that Congress may make that pause permanent." Reuters report added, "Any new funding would need the support of at least some Republicans in Congress, who hold a majority in the House of Representatives. Many have expressed their opposition to UNRWA." It cited a statement by Representative Brian Mast, the Republican chair of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Oversight and Accountability, one of the opponents, as alleging that UNRWA is a front. Brian Mast claimed, "It masquerades as a relief organization whilst building the infrastructure to support Hamas." Back in February, the United Nations agency UNRWA said some of its employees had been tortured by the Israeli regime to falsely admit that the agency has ties with Hamas and its retaliatory operation last October. The assertion made in a February report by UNRWA detailed various cases of mistreatment in Israeli detention centers against Palestinians, including several Palestinians who worked for UNRWA. The document said several UNRWA Palestinian staffers had been detained by the Israeli occupation army in Gaza, and that the ill treatment and abuse that said they had experienced include severe physical beatings, waterboarding, and threats of harm to their family members. The report said UNRWA staff members have been subject to threats and coercion by the Israeli authorities whilst in Israeli detention, and pressure to make false statements against the agency, including that the agency has affiliations with Hamas, and that UNRWA staff members took part in the 7th of October 2023 operation. The website of the Mehr News Agency has also covered this same story and tells us more. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has rejected a statement by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, about aid supplies to the Gaza Strip, saying it is a declaration of the international community's failure. The resistance group made the remark on Wednesday, 13th of March, after UNRWA said there is no international will to bring aid into Gaza in light of the widespread and expanding famine in the besieged territory. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said this is a declaration of failure for the international community and the United Nations, and submission to the policies of genocide carried out by the Israeli regime against our Palestinian people. It further called on all active parties to take immediate action to force the Israeli regime to open all land crossings with the Gaza Strip, particularly the Rafah and Kerem Shalom border crossings. The group also emphasized the need to address the security of emergency food supplies, which threatens hundreds of children with death. After the death toll of children due to malnutrition and dehydration reached approximately 30. The Israeli military has restricted the delivery of humanitarian supplies and aid to northern Gaza Strip for weeks, and thousands of Palestinian children are currently going without adequate food and medication. The prevention of aid convoys comes as humanitarian officials have already issued a dire warning stating that unless a ceasefire is implemented and aid is significantly increased in the Gaza Strip, the toll of malnutrition and disease is expected to rise, leading to an alarming loss of lives. Hunger has become the most pressing issue, with myriad problems facing millions of displaced Palestinians in Gaza, with aid trucks only able to bring in a small fraction of what is needed and distributed unevenly due to chaos in the territory. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based human rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to devastating Israeli war on the territory, and the Israeli regime's method of using starvation and hunger as a weapon of war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor conducted an analytical study on a sample of 1,200 people in the Gaza Strip. A high proportion of those who took part in the study admitted that they ate insufficient amounts of food. 64% admitted that they ate grass. And also many people admitted that they had eaten expired food products.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Tigo, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
The company is Brown & Williamson, America's third largest tobacco company. The man they've set out to destroy is Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, their former $300,000 a year director of research.
In 1996, another revelation was made on CBS's 60 Minutes program. Jeffrey Wigand, one of the personnel of the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company, leaked significant information about the tobacco industry. Michael Mann made a movie out of the developments named The Insider, starring Russell Crowe, who played the role of Jeffrey Wigand. The movie received accolade by film critics.
Catch you in a lie. They can paint everything with that brush. You understand?
Everything you say.
I told the truth.
Everything you say.
And I can't defend you, man, with one hand tied behind my back.